Welcome to the Hour of the Time, broadcasting truth to all of you all around the world on WWCR, Worldwide Christian Radio. On Thanksgiving evening, November 25th, 1993, the 217th year of the United States of America. This is my first broadcast. I hope you'll bear with me. You must all ask yourself, is this our last Thanksgiving? And you must restate it and say, you all must tell yourself, this is not our last Thanksgiving. We will not be gobbled up. Gobble, gobble, gobble. Loglia is going to resume discussion of his germ theory on part two of four parts. He's a Kaji researcher from New York City. And you'll remember that we are not able to 100% confirm his theory and conduct our own research here. Thus, we ask you to research for yourself and to determine the truth of all that you hear. You can talk to Alex about his message, which can be life-saving.
Howdy, folks. Hope you heard last night's show, because tonight I am continuing with the germ theory topic. I'm going to begin with a quote from the work of Dr. Bill Holub, who I had mentioned yesterday. All of his work is very well documented, and what you're about to hear is the nexus of 30 years of work. Yet, it is simple, clear, direct, and profound. Pay attention, folks. Here is the up-to-date proof of the absolute idiocy of the germ theory, and also a glimpse at the reality of what the phenomenon that we call disease consists of. Now, remember what I spoke of yesterday. Bacteria and viruses are not form-fixed. They mutate and change according to the medium they are in. They are with us, inside of us constantly, and function both to build tissue and to decompose waste. And remember also that what we call disease is the elimination of toxins that we take in. Germs appear when our body is eliminating these toxins because the medium becomes conducive to them. They are not the cause, however. Germs are not the cause of disease. They come out
of our very substance. They are not from the outside. You don't catch anything. They come from within. And Bishop showed this very clearly in his work. Again, I will refer you to Bishop or Pasteur, the book by Hume. It is very interesting and is a rather wonderful piece of biological history there. But let me go on with Bill Holub here, again from the work that I was quoting yesterday. This chapter is entitled, "The New Germ Theory is Supported by the New Biology." Let us bring all this historical information up to the knowledge we have today. We need here to define and explain three terms: germs, genetics, and evolution. Germs. We are defining germs here to include all manner of microorganisms, including viroids, viruses, bacteria, fungus, protozoa, etc. The new information from molecular biology, biochemistry, and many other fields of research all support this proper view of the role of germs in human health. Dr. Lewis Thomas, in the book Lives of a Cell, says of viruses, quote, "Instead of being single-minded agents of disease and death, they now begin to look more like mobile genes. We live in a dancing matrix of viruses. They dart, rather like bees, from organism to organism, from plant to insect to mammal to me and back again and into the sea, transplanting grafts of DNA, passing around heredity as though at a great party. They may be the mechanism for keeping new mutant kinds of DNA in the widest possible circulation among us." And let me just remind you of what Bishop had said many years ago, which I mentioned yesterday, about the microzymas, because indeed modern research clearly indicates that what Bishop was seeing as microzymas are viruses and viral material. Moving on with Bill Holub. Germs are one-celled protozoa or subcellular parts of whole cells, which are basically immortal and have been in existence since the origin of life on this planet. They were here long before we were, so there was nothing to attack then, just as they attack nothing now. They are the basic unit of life, and in a sense, then, we are a collection or living condominium of attached germs surviving as a group because of cooperation. Germs, then, are an integral and vital part of our function, including growth, maintenance, and repair. They are also our link to the cycle of life on this planet. Thus, they begin to recycle our structure whenever we allow that malnourished situation to occur. But realize that they would not and could not attack you. It would be like attacking themselves, and this would never occur. As Aristotle pointed out, quote, "Nature does nothing uselessly," and Zeno concurred, "The goal of life is living in agreement with nature." Germs do not attack. They assist in healing and have the facility to do things which the remainder of our cells and tissues cannot do. They synthesize much of our needed vitamins and other nutrients. They help to detoxify dangerous substances from our environment. They provide a needed communication with our environment, both internal and external. They help in our constant adaptation to a constantly changing environment. They even allow for the exchange of important information from one part of our body to another, and from one organism to another, and from one person to another. God knows we need the germs, for they are us. Genetics. Genes are part of the cell that ensure the immortality of the cell. They transmit the needed current information to help one-celled or the multi-celled organism, which is people, survive. However, we used to be taught that once you, quote-unquote, inherited something, it is unchangeable, but this is not so. Much recent high-tech research has shown that there is a constant interplay between genes and their environment. This means that genes affect potential characteristics. The actual expression of any gene is dependent upon environmental factors, including nutrition, light, toxins, etc. Some excellent work reported in 1985 in the July 20th edition of Science News, by L. Reed, reaffirms once again that the environment in which a cell exists determines its survival and behavior. By manipulating cell culture media, they succeeded in mimicking liver cells in various healthy and diseased states. They showed that the matrix in which a cell or a human finds themselves influences the regulation of cell growth and specialization by turning on certain genes while turning off others. Thus, you do not inherit diseases, but inherit potential blueprints for the healthy state. By heeding the blueprints and using the right or nourishing building material, the healthy state can be achieved. However, if you try to work outside of the blueprints or use inferior materials for your construction, such as junk food, medications, etc., then poor health will surely result. Viruses, viroids, and the like appear to be a way to transmit and change the genetic makeup of organisms like us in order to ensure survival. We may very well be making viruses by spin-off material from our cells, which are more like stuck-together viruses anyway. Evolution. By evolution, we simply mean the gradual changes in organisms and their environment, which occur always. These changes represent adaptations of an organism to its constantly changing environment. They include a wide range of cyclic changes. For example, day and night, lunar cycles, seasons, etc. They also include longer geological and population and social changes which may occur in cycles of decades or centuries. Thus, the various organisms which we see inhabiting man are really adaptive changes in the organisms in response to changes to their changing environment, namely you. You are the changing environment for these quote-unquote germs and bacteria. Understand that, folks. Germs change in response to your nourishment status. If you are well nourished, then certain germs flourish. If you are poorly nourished, then other kinds of germs grow, which also adapt to the different metabolic situations in your body. Just to give you a simple example, if you become malnourished, then less oxygen and nutrients get to your cells and they die off at a more rapid rate, leaving protein and other types of cell waste byproducts. All this provides food for certain quote-unquote new versions of microbes which can survive in low oxygen, low nutrient, high nitrogen waste circumstances. So, the germs didn't suddenly invade you and make you sick. They simply changed to adapt to your sickness. Again, germs are a consequence of disease, not the cause. So if you go on a fast or follow other natural healing modalities, the nature of the germs change back to those found in the healthy state. The germs have always been and shall always be. They are here sharing this world with us and help us when we need them. They are ancient and they are immortal. A recent article in The Lancet by John Heyman combines microbiology and paleontology to show that a particular germ, Mycobacterium ulcerans, is at least more than 200 million years old and inhabits the same regions of the Earth as part of the continents that were once connected but have long since separated, which is South America, Africa, and Australia. Germs as guardian angels, infection as a healing event. If we accept, as I think we must, that germs are not here to give us pain or to kill us, why would they want to kill their host, or to create the antibiotic vaccination industry, then why are they here? We believe we have the answer to this question, and the answer is something wonderful, not something to fear. Germs are part and parcel of the healing process. That's right, they are participating in the healing process. Just look at what they are capable of doing and see how they can participate in healing. They are able to break down waste products of our metabolism and of our cellular debris. They can exist on low oxygen or even no oxygen, which are anaerobes. They can break down toxic substances in our body that we could not break down, such as plastics, pesticides, artificial ingredients, toxic waste, etc. Furthermore, let us not forget that they also provide a good deal of our vitamin supply by their ability to synthesize vitamins inside us, including B12, niacin, vitamin K, vitamin C, etc. Now, isn't this a blessing in disguise? Another very important role, especially for viroids, which are smaller than viruses, and viruses themselves, is their potential role in helping our cells to adapt to a rapidly changing environment and to transmit, or better, share this information from cell to cell in your body. Think of the marvelous system that allows a virus to use and alter the genetic makeup of one of our cells and then share this information with thousands of other cells. Modern medicine calls this infection, folks. Viroids, which are tiny particles of DNA or RNA, much smaller than viruses, have been studied extensively in plants because they cause non-commercial mutations of potatoes, tomatoes, etc. But studies have shown that these viroids have only started affecting crops subject to 20th century high-tech agriculture with its total alienation of natural processes. It's the old story. When you seriously alter the natural development of an organism by inbreeding, artificial feeding, chemical fertilizers, toxic exposure, mechanical harvesting, etc., you create the need for these germ-assisted alterations. However, these alterations are for the survival of the organism. Of course, for the organism to survive, say a potato, it may not resemble the potato that people are used to buying and eating. But nature is not concerned with aesthetic appeal, but with survival and immortality. How does this help you? We are writing this in late spring, and people around us are complaining about runny noses, coughs, etc., all caused supposedly by a bug that is going around. Here is what is really happening. Spring brings out green growth and the weeds and insects that go along with it. This brings out America's arsenal of chemical fertilizers, lime, weed killers, bug killers, etc. This toxic insult to our environment brings about the need for significant healing and adaptation amongst all of us exposed to it. The quote-unquote colds, runny nose, cough, etc. are your body's way of dumping the toxic material out, and here is where the germs play a critical role. While the bacteria are busy digesting away some of these toxic substances inside of us, the viruses are transmitting the information on how we may adapt to this toxic onslaught. Viruses enter and replicate in those cells of ours which can survive the toxic exposure, and as the virus replicates in other cells, it, in essence, is transmitting this survival advantage to thousands of our cells. Companies have even smartened up to the fact that germs participate in healing and are trying to steal and market their powers. A Dr. Todaro from Oncogene Incorporated describes a growth factor from vaccinia virus, which is smallpox, which can significantly enhance wound healing. Germs are part of our healing, and we would do well to work with them. The myth of contagion and transmission of disease. This updated version of medicine's old evil spirits and spells suits their non-humanistic and high-tech mechanistic treatment of patients today. It's very simple. As we have already indicated, all germs are ubiquitous, present in everyone, everywhere, all the time. Each person has their own private collection of germs suitable to them specifically, so if they are to become ill, they have plenty of their own bugs. They couldn't and wouldn't catch them from anyone. We are not saying here that germs don't move about the environment, but rather that they do not jump from one person to another to produce illness. In fact, all of the information about epidemics seems to prove that there is no transmission of germs occurring. For example, why do most quote-unquote epidemics occur in winter when people are less exposed publicly to each other? Why do epidemics strike large numbers of people at the same time and never show a spreading type of incidence which one would expect to see if indeed germs are being transmitted from person to person? Why is it that regions that have large interchanges of people like New York and Florida do not show the infections following the people? Why do epidemics frequently follow patterns around holidays like Thanksgiving or Christmas? Do germs know that these are holidays? What is really happening with these supposed epidemics is the following. Actually, the word epidemic from the Greek means literally on or at, and people, and means something that happens to people as a group all at once, not a slow contagion. The actual epidemic process is very simple. Remember that everyone already has their daily complement of germs, and remember also that a large population of people, such as a town, a region, or city, is constantly being exposed to the same environmental hazards all at the same time. For example, large numbers of people are exposed to the same weather changes, water quality changes, pesticides, food and water, contaminated food of a fast food chain, bad news in the media, batches of drugs and medications, holiday moods, air quality changes, and many other toxic insults. The quote-unquote group healing reaction to these toxic challenges is what you are seeing when people start coughing, sneezing, or whatever. They are not catching it from each other, they are experiencing it with others. In addition, at many levels we are all connected. About the only thing that is catching about all of this is paranoia. After all, medicine has had about a century to literally instill the fear of germs into our culture. So people fear the germs in the air, in the water. They fear germs from touching people, which in turn leads to our general fear of people. When they read or see reports about infections going around, so to speak, the fear, paranoia, and anticipation has been shown to lower immunity and precipitate illness. Now, isn't that interesting? Our self-imposed stress about holidays has the same effect. Another important facet of this germology, which shocks so many people, is that science actually cannot isolate the germ involved in any disease. What they isolate is a version of the original, and in the case of viruses, that version may actually bear very little or no resemblance to the original germ in somebody's body. This means that as soon as you start the process of isolating and identifying a germ, you totally lose the feature of the original copy. Recall that germs reproduce very rapidly and also mutate or change themselves very rapidly as their environment changes. Thus, the very involved process of culturing and transfer involved in the science of microbiology totally changes the germ so that by the time it is isolated for study, it is no longer the germ that was originally taken from the human subject. What we study about germs in tissue, cell, or media culture has nothing to do with their activity in the human, so you can't prove that the original germ is causing anything. This paradoxical problem in biology is known by any good scientist, namely, that the study changes the circumstances and, at least as far as germs go, one cannot study them in their natural habitat. The problem is exemplified by you trying to catch your own shadow in the shape it is at any moment. As soon as you make a move to trap your shadow, it changes its shape. Therefore, you can never really see what your shadow looks like without changing it, and the same is true for germs. Still another problem is quantity of germs. If germs are not in quantity, they cannot be proven to exist in a human. This means that everyone has a few thousand herpes organisms alive in them, but that number is undetectable by science. Yet another problem is the presence of antibodies to germs. Unfortunately, this proves nothing at all. It could mean you have a lot of the certain organism, or some, or very little, or none. You cannot link antibody titers to presence or absence of infection at all. Again, that was from the work of Dr. Bill Holub, folks. Now, I'm sure a lot of questions are raised in your mind. Everybody who hears this stuff gets all upset, and they say, what about massive epidemics? What about the Black Plague? All that kind of stuff. I love the Black Plague as an example. I mean, you're talking about large-scale, quote-unquote, epidemic devastating Europe, blaming it on the little flea and the organism that was going through the flea and the rats. But remember, folks, you're talking about a time in Europe when people were eating lard pies three meals a day and the sewer was out in the street. Think about that. Think about the plagues of very early times in Rome and up through now to modern history. And I can, every example, I can give you reasons why those things occurred. My other argument I get is, what about polio? What about syphilis? What about aseptic meningitis, AIDS? Well, we're going to talk about that in the next two shows because I'm going to dedicate the next two shows to AIDS specifically. It's really the single greatest medical fraud that I have ever seen. But if you look at polio, and as I had mentioned on the show for vaccines, you will find that the definitions for the symptoms of non-paralytic polio match almost precisely to the symptoms for aseptic meningitis, which match almost exactly to what we are now classifying as AIDS. It's the same old renaming game, folks. It's the renaming game, and I can show you that what we are calling AIDS has been around for years. Now remember, AIDS is acquired immune deficiency syndrome, and they are saying that it is caused by a new virus called HIV. Hopefully, over the next two shows after this one, I will show you that HIV causes nothing. But get it fixed in your mind from what I just read, folks, that germs do not cause disease. Epidemics are caused by a lot of different things, but have nothing to do with germs and viruses. They are a consequence, not the cause. If you want to look for causes of particular diseases, I suggest you start with looking at immunization programs, and that has been a fun little project of mine. But you can trace most of the major quote-unquote epidemics of our age, including cancer, to vaccinations. AIDS is a fun one. We're going to talk about it another time, so I'm not going to belabor that point with discussion right now. The next thing I am going to read you is a little excerpt from another piece of Dr. Bill Holub's work about germs and disease. And it's a portion relating to Dr. Holub's specific explanation about herpes as an example of a specific disease and how the theory that we call the germ theory really cannot apply and does not apply. So, at this point, let Bill take his break, and we'll flip the tape over in a little while, and we'll be back in a few minutes with the work from Dr. Bill Holub on herpes. Okay, from Dr. Bill Holub. As we have already explained previously, germs do not cause disease, but are a consequence of it. Germs, including viruses, viroids, bacteria, fungus, etc., are an essential feature of the cycling of matter in our world. Remember that each and every speck of substance that makes you up is simply recycled from our environment through eating, breathing, and drinking. That's why God, as nature, has placed germs on earth, to continue the natural cycling of material. If we could destroy all germs on earth, then all life, including the human race, would cease to exist. So germs perform a useful imperative function. They are not here to create disease, fear, infection, epidemics, or the medical pharmaceutical industry's profits. It is a simple process of recycling. When a person becomes chronically malnourished, nourishment, of course, meaning the natural balance of all inputs required to sustain optimum health, i.e. water, food, activity, love, touch, spiritual stuff, etc., the germs which have always resided in the body view that person as food or organic matter which needs to be recycled. If the person becomes sufficiently malnourished, then they may die, and all manner of germs will proliferate upon them, but those germs did not kill them. They died from severe malnourishment, and the germs only began their job of recycling the material of the body. Therefore, herpes is an innocent bystander, only doing its recycling job when you begin to become malnourished. Herpes is not the enemy. It did not invade or attack. It has no goal of creating misery and pain. It has no reason to proliferate on a person unless they become malnourished enough. And I will add, malnourished enough to change the medium, the body that the herpes is in, so that it can proliferate. Continuing with Dr. Holub, the person with herpes, AIDS, or cancer is their own enemy. You cannot catch herpes. That's right. You cannot catch herpes because you always had it. Germs are ubiquitous in our environment, which means that every single person always has them as part of their structure from birth. So even though germs always move about in our environment and from person to person, they are already present in everyone. That's right. Even if you think that you were never exposed to or quote-unquote had herpes, botulism, syphilis, strep, etc., you already have them inside you. Realize that every last part of your body is always teeming inside and out with trillions of different germs. They live on you as we live on this planet. So why doesn't everyone get herpes? Remember, herpes only will proliferate on a person that is sufficiently malnourished. Malnourishment can also be viewed as the result of bad balancing of toxic intake, smoking, drugs, medications, etc., with nutrient intakes like water, food, vitamins, sun, etc. States of malnourishment are similar in people, in countries, communities, neighborhoods, families, workplaces, and relationships. Because malnourishment is so widespread, it is not at all unusual for 2 people or 1,000 people to develop herpes around the same time. But remember that they did not give it to each other. They all already had herpes laying around, sleeping inside them, waiting for the call to duty. Their duty being the simple recycling job. Malnourishment simply wakes them up and gets them to work. Why herpes? Could medical immunizations be to blame? In the world of germs, just as in the world of people, there is a hierarchy of existence. So trillions of germs are always competing for turf throughout our environment and within all of us. At any one point in time, the germ that happens to be on the top of the heap, so to speak, will be the one to proliferate on all those malnourished people. This occurs over long spans of time, which medicine refers to as epidemics. What medicine does not understand is that these popular germs come and go as a natural process, and they are not contagious by natural routes of exposure, and they are not at all stopped by immunizations or vaccination programs of recent history, which you heard on my last show, or the show before that, rather. In fact, it is interesting to note that the current herpes simplex virus is a very close companion and relative to the cytomegalic inclusion virus, which has been linked with AIDS, and to the virus of infectious mononucleosis, and to the poliomyelitis virus. That's the poliomyelitis virus. America may well be suffering from unusual and unnatural germs inoculated into us by the 1950s polio vaccine program, which not only created an increase in polio cases, which were already disappearing at the time, as I noted, but may have left America in a typical 30-year legacy being experienced as the current epidemics. I should point out that similar vaccine-introduced viruses have been implicated in cancer, particularly in children. So, quote-unquote, modern medicine, through ignorance of natural processes, may have given man not freedom from specific infectious diseases, but rather a series of synthetically altered germs introduced into our bodies in ways nature could not have foreseen. Now, with medicine meddling with genetic engineering of germs, they may yet develop a germ whose job may be to destroy mankind, a germ made by man, not God. We should all hope not. Now, on this note, I'm going to read you a bit about some of the more nefarious characters in the world of modern medical research. Let me read you a bit about Dr. Wolf Moonis from Dr. William Campbell Douglas's book, AIDS. The End of Civilization, I believe, is the title. Very interesting stuff. Dr. Smunis was a Polish Jew who supposedly ended up in a Siberian labor camp during World War II. But after the war, he somehow became a privileged person, was sent to a medical school in Tomsk, Russia, and married a Russian woman, hardly typical treatment of an enemy of the Soviet state. Smunis' biographer said that Wolf was always reluctant to discuss, quote-unquote, those dark years in Siberia. Maybe he was reluctant because he wasn't in Siberia. If he was, he certainly wasn't shoveling salt. In 1959, the Soviet government allowed him to practice in Poland in a public health capacity. Standard policy in all communist countries is never to allow all members of a family to travel out of the country to the West at the same time. This eliminates 98% of all defection attempts. I have physician friends in Hungary, for example. He can go to a meeting anywhere in the world if she stays home. She can go if he stays home. They can both go if the children are left at home. But in 1969, the entire Smunis family was allowed by Communist Poland to go to a medical meeting in Italy. At that time, they quote-unquote defected and moved to New York City. With no American credentials whatsoever, he immediately got a job as a lab technician at the New York City Blood Center. Within a few years, this Polish immigrant was given his own lab. A separate department of epidemiology was created for him at the blood bank, and he, like the chrysalis turning into a butterfly, changed into a full professor of epidemiology at the Columbia Medical School. Curiouser and curiouser. In 6 years, this lab tech became a full professor and then went back to Moscow for a scientific presentation and was received as a dignitary, not a defector. Well, we tell you this amazing story because in retrospect, it is obvious that Wolf Smunis was a carefully groomed communist agent planted here after years of preparation to instigate biological warfare against the American people. Smunis, with full cooperation and financial support of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and the National Institute of Health, masterminded the hepatitis B vaccine experimental program used on homosexual men. He insisted that only young, promiscuous homosexuals be allowed to participate in the experiment. The experiment started in New York at the blood bank in November 1978. The experimental vaccine was produced in a government-supervised laboratory. The study was completed in October 1979. Within 10 years, most of these young men would be dead or dying from AIDS. In 1980, the program was expanded to major cities all across the U.S. In the fall of 1980, the first AIDS cases was reported in San Francisco. 8 years later, most of the homosexuals in San Francisco were infected, dead, or dying. In 1986, Dr. Clad Stevens, one of Smunis' collaborators, penned an astonishing report that did not make your local newspaper. She reported that the majority of the homosexuals in the experimental program were infected with the AIDS virus. The AIDS-laced vaccine, through the bridge of bisexual men, now infects as many as 3 million Americans. Mission accomplished. Now, folks, let me just add that the end part of this, about the AIDS-infected, AIDS-laced vaccine, I have yet to find the documentation that supports that. I am not saying that it does not exist. But I have to tell you that the conclusions that Dr. Douglas arrived about the AIDS epidemic are not in harmony with my own findings, and I'll talk about that on my show about AIDS. But I want you to keep all this in the back of your mind. Like I said, I don't totally agree with Dr. Douglas's conclusion, but you'll hear about that tomorrow. You'll see clearly, and I'm sure you may see clearly now, vaccinations do not need to be laced with anything. The simple fact of injecting virulent free-floating proteins and viral material into the bloodstream is more than enough. Now, I don't doubt that billions are spent by governments worldwide to produce all kinds of nasty diseases and cancer-producing stuff, but you must realize that the reality of how the body functions is not understood even by these scientists who may have amazing understandings of microbiology, virology, and immunology. Let's move on and leave it for tomorrow's show. I'm going to read a bit more from Dr. Douglas's book, which, by the way, is an incredible piece of research, very well documented. And again, it's called AIDS, The End of Civilization. Just for fun, I'm going to share some very interesting bits and pieces of information with you. What the Soviet propagandists didn't say was that their agents had been working in our top security biological warfare laboratories for over 20 years. In a burst of brotherly love, they were invited in by President Richard Nixon. The astounded communist scientists from Russia, the Eastern Bloc, and communist China, who had been trying to penetrate this vital security area for 40 years, quickly accepted. They had been snickering in their beakers ever since, while they prepare for our demise. It is no secret that they are there. Dr. Carlton Gegesek, a top official at the Fort Detrick Laboratory, said in Omni Magazine in March 1986, "In the facility I have a building where more good and loyal communist scientists from the USSR and mainland China work, with full passkeys to all the labs, than there are Americans. Even the Army's infectious disease unit is loaded with foreign workers, not always friendly nationals." You can't put it more plainly than that. Even the Greeks weren't that stupid. They didn't know the Trojan horse was full of soldiers. When it became obvious to the communist press that we were getting the truth out about who was running things at Fort Detrick, they completely reversed themselves and said it was all a mistake. Everything was just fine at Fort Detrick. Moving on a little down the road here. You are probably not aware that the International AIDS Prevention Program of the World Health Organization is run by the Soviets. You don't believe it? Call WHO and ask them who is in charge in Europe. If you want to save your nickel, I'll tell you now. He's a Russian named Bysenko, and he operates out of Copenhagen. I am not sure of the spelling of his name, but I can tell you he spells deep trouble for the West. The Soviets control the response to AIDS of the entire free world at many levels, including the top. Dr. Sergei Litvinov, the coordinator of all task force work on AIDS at the World Health Organization, is a high official in the Soviet Ministry of Health. Litvinov gave out the order to our scientists and medical organizations in the Western world not to discuss the real cause of the AIDS epidemic. Now, bear in mind, of course, folks, that Dr. Douglas is of the belief that it was created right here in Fort Detrick, and he puts forth a lot of evidence for that. We'll talk about that tomorrow. At a secret meeting between the editors of The Lancet, the highly respected British medical publication, and a group of the leading retrovirologists of the world, it was decided not to publish any academic discussions about the possible artificial creation of the AIDS virus in a lab. They particularly agreed not to make any mention of world-renowned biologist Isaac Farlane Burnett's published remarks that molecular biology may get out of hand like atomic physics and be used for evil purposes. Now, other medical journals, such as Science and the JAMA, have lockstepped with Lancet and put all references to the man-made origins of AIDS down the memory hole. Did Comrade Litvinov have a little talk with the retrovirologists? They, of course, wouldn't need any encouragement from their Soviet UN bosses to attempt a little cover-up for their own heinous crime. But Lancet, the British Medical Journal, and the New England Journal of Medicine are another matter. It took some powerful and sinister forces indeed to get these respected publications to cover up the crime of the millennium. The notable exception to this appalling censorship of mass murder is Professor Harding Raines, editor of Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine. Raines refers to a, quote, conspiracy of silence covering the allegation that AIDS was man-made. I hope Dr. Raines is watching his backside. Now, Dr. Zoris A. Medvedev, unlike Bysenko and Litvinov, supposedly is a Russian exile. Medvedev operates out of London at the National Institute for Medical Research. He's a senior research scientist in the genetics division. He, like Smunis, blossomed from a poor exile into a man of power and influence. Medvedev, before he was exiled, was head of radiobiology at a top-secret Soviet medical research center. Since when do the Soviets exile a key scientist in the field that will be decisive in World War III, which is radiobiology? There's a lot more about this now British citizen and respectable scientist who continues to communicate freely with his supposed enemies in the Soviet biowarfare labs. We'll tell you more later. Medvedev is spreading the disinformation that AIDS is rampant in Russia due to the escape of the virus from a laboratory, a sort of biological Chernobyl. This tends to divert suspicion away from Litvinov, Smoozness, and the other Reds that President Nixon allowed to penetrate our biological laboratories at Fort Detrick. Having the Soviets, quote, control the spread of AIDS in the West has led to some interesting paradoxes. Our masters at the UN tell us that there shall be absolutely no restriction on travel between various parts of the non-communist world. Koop supports the Soviet policy of biological suicide. Are those the instructions he received when he made his trip to Moscow, where the WHO had set up its main AIDS research center? A very interesting question. But our Soviet protectors in the WHO tell us this open policy of international travel does not apply to the communist bloc of nations. If you or I were to visit Moscow and tested positive for AIDS virus, pow, out on the next plane. If they stay clean through their immigration policies and we die because of the immigration policies imposed on us through the UN-controlled World Health Organization, who needs atomic bombs for conquest? Unless the Western world gets its act together and closes down the UN, especially its genocide division called the WHO, freedom and decency will disappear from the planet Earth. But the problem goes much deeper. How do you close down the U.S. government laboratories such as the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, and the National Institute of Health, and the Fort Detrick Biowarfare Lab when the perpetrators of the crime are in control at all levels? I don't know the answer. I thought that was a rather interesting little quote there from Dr. Douglas. Now, again, I want to stress to you that I read that piece to let you know about some of the machinations that are going on in the world of medical research. I don't agree with almost anything that Dr. Douglas believes about AIDS, because it just not has stood up under my research. I read this section a bit guardedly and with a little bit of a devious intention. Dr. Douglas has indeed done some fantastic research, and his book is fantastic. It's definitely something to check out. But my opinion is that his approach is a bit misguided. Now, I understand his outrage at discovering all of this insidious conspiring against the populations of the Earth, but my own research, and more importantly, my own personal experience, points me in another direction regarding AIDS. Folks, HIV does not cause AIDS. AIDS is an unbelievable scam, a hoax, a mirage. And remember, when we're talking about AIDS, we're talking about something called acquired immune deficiency syndrome, and we're talking about a virus whose acronym is HIV. You see, what most of these scientists have not recognized is the truly amazing healing powers of a healthy human organism. Of course, they have been making sure that we stay unhealthy for centuries by poisoning us, mostly via our foods and medicine, and that would be a great show on its own. Maybe someday I'll get to that. But understand that the picture is not so bleak. Your health is not at all outside of your own control. In fact, the reality is that only you can take the steps which will ensure that you will be able to remain healthy. Now, in fact, we are drowning in a mire of disinformation regarding diseases that are allegedly afflicting the human race. I hope you all agree that I have managed to at least give you some doubt regarding the historical presentation that has been handed down to us regarding vaccines and the germ theory. And this is all building up to something, folks, because tomorrow's show, I will be talking about AIDS. My first installment on AIDS, and there'll be another show about that, because it is a big one. This is an issue that I am absolutely outraged by. And if you had seen what I have seen over the last 10 years, you would understand why I am so outraged with AIDS. The time is ripe for the truth to come out about this scam called AIDS. And if you tune in tomorrow night, I'll begin the first of the two-part series I've taped here for Bill about it. We're going to show you how AIDS is not a gay or even a sexually transmitted disease. Show you it's not a new disease. Show you it's not a worldwide epidemic. Show you it's not caused by HIV or any other germ. It's not diagnosable by any lab test, and it's not increasing in blacks, women, and children.
And we're definitely going to show you that it's not responsive to any vaccine and most certainly cannot be dealt with by poisonous, toxic chemotherapies like AZT and the like. Folks, right now, where we are today, most people dying of AIDS are dying from treatment, but we'll get into that tomorrow. This is an issue that is going to affect you whether you like it or not, whether it be through the issue of mandatory AIDS testing, through AIDS vaccinations, and the like. I hope you will tune in. I think what I've accumulated over the last few years is valuable. I've put it together, and I have the research of some of the top scientists and researchers that I know of in this world with integrity behind me. I hope you will tune in. If you want to correspond with me about anything I've mentioned on any of the shows I've done, please feel free. I love the exchange of information, and I want to get as much of what I have out to people as possible. My address, Alex Loglia, L-O-G-L-I-A, 217 East 85th Street, Suite 246, New York, New York, 10028. That's Alex Loglia, L-O-G-L-I-A, 217 East 85th Street, Suite 246, New York, New York, 10028. If you'd like, you can include a phone number, and I will get in touch with you by phone. Good night, folks. Take care, and I hope you will tune in tomorrow.
Thanks, Alex. I think your message went straight to the heart, and we'll be looking into it. Write to Alex and call Jean. Jean Miller at Swiss America, 1-800-BUY-COIN.
So they say, his brother came and they let it slip away. Love, like the autumn sun, should be dying, but it's only just begun. Like the twilight in the road up ahead, they don't see just where we're going. All the secrets in the universe in our ears all the years come and go. Take us up, always up. We will never catch a wave again. We may never catch a wave again. We may never catch a wave again. Day. For the fools in they let them get away. See, like the silent dove, should be flying, but it's only just begun. Like Columbus in the olden days, we must gather all our courage.
Till death do us all part. From the United States of America, happy Thanksgiving. God bless you all.
I won't let